Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore. We're glad you are tuned in. We continue today with Connie Ellis's reading of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly, a novel about a handful of people in a northern Minnesota town. We pick up now where Connie left off last time.
Chapter 4 continues. When Vern got to the far end, he had looked back. The assistant was now slipping the animals off his pan into a bin-style door in the wall. A frame directive near Vern ordered that no one was to carry deads in a disrespectful manner. No animal was to be transported by its neck or by any single limb. Subjects were to be placed on the subject pans, just as a person would be laid onto a gurney. And important, this printed with an exclamation mark like those on PCs. Are you sure you want to delete this document? No subject was to be taken anywhere but between their hutches and the tall lab tables or to the terminal ramps on the north wall. Terminal ramps, Vern thought. Those would be the bin doors, like gravity tunnels to an incinerator area below. And, the young woman said because he paused, he went on talking. You see, he told her, I was slow to catch on. There isn't any research into any garden bacteria or viruses or mold. Oh, yes, there is, the woman said. We could show it to you. In fact, she added in a bright tone, this might convince you. In that hometown of yours, you've got a very savvy planning strawberry farmer who stays in touch with us. No problem, Vern. I want to quit, he cried. I want to quit. She stood up and came around to his side of her desk. She sat on its edge and looked down at him. She said, there's no problem, Vern. Is that all you came to me about? Yes, yes, I suppose it is, he said. Yes. He shook himself. What do you mean, no problem? She quite openly looked at her watch. She said, just that. Her two hands, cupped like a statesman's hands, lay peacefully across her thigh. Let's see, it is only 4:20 now, so you can gather your things and leave. I'll see that people get your paperwork to you Tuesday. He told her he, of course, was prepared to spend another week finishing up the two departmental projects his subgroup were still tweaking. In the two road lectures that had been scheduled in stone for him 3 months ago, and some approvals for the website environment discussion project, we aren't 100% out of the woods with that yet. A week should do it. Not at all, Vern, she said in a warm tone. You go clean out your desk right now. Never mind the roadshow. Don't worry about the website thing. You can quit in peace. We think very highly of you, you know. But right now, you know how it is on Fridays. And she gave him a smile that was oddly fleshy for such a thin face. Vern started to his feet. Was it over then? He thought, was it over so fast? He tried to sound low-key. I wasn't sure exactly whom I should go to for this. Again her smile. You mean, you wondered quite naturally, Vern. I mean, we're all human beings, and I am senior enough to accept your resignation. Yes, I'm able to take your resignation. It's all A-OK. Everything is A-OK. A-OK, he said. Absolutely, Vern. The smile spread over the cool meat of her face. You shouldn't worry whether or not you are making a career mistake. Absolutely no worry. Consider your resignation complete. Our people attended your lectures and taking part in two of the symposia you put together have the greatest admiration for you, the greatest. You're just about as good as it gets. Actually, though, I would have had to let you go before Christmas in any case. So this is best, and you should feel you've made a wise move here. He tottered back down the long empty hall, out the door, and started off like a robot along the mesh fence. Now the mid-November sun had dropped low enough to cast its mesh cage shadow on his face. Vern slammed himself into his car. He drove along 694 safely, only because he always drove carefully. Going east on I-694, and a quarter of an hour later north with the Friday afternoon traffic on 35E, he pounded his fist again and again on the rubber-gripped wheel. He could hardly credit that the icy chick technocrat had contrived it so that the company he had meant to reject for gross cruelty had crippled his great moment into merely getting fired. His confidence lay shattered about him. She must have spotted some essential dullness inside him and had decided for the fun of it to turn his ethical stance into nothing but humiliation. He tipped down the rear-view mirror. Its little coffin-shaped glass showed him his dull face. Well, it was a dull face. Reliable, yes, reliable, but reliability is what a man wants from a dog. On the other hand, his eyes looked back at him like two jewels. All right, he said calmly aloud, all right. He gave the mirror a few more glances. Perhaps women did not like such a face any better than he did at this moment. Was that true? No, that wasn't true. Women liked him. His guess was that even Imogen Tenebrae liked him, and the Episcopal priest Eliza, too, and Pearl, the foul-mouthed organist who did locum tenens for any church at 25 a time. She'd given him a friendly, lewd look once that had made up for a bad day. And that woman who seemed to be the program assistant for Imogen at her mediocre Duluth Women for Peace organization. Only last week she'd cornered him between the chuffing furnace and a broken file cabinet. She made him the classical speech of its kind. The point was, she explained, that unlike other women, she always tried to follow her most inmost intuitions because she felt they came from the deepest place inside her. And this said with eyes pinioning him, he got what she was trying to say. She was one of those people with the carefully straggled hair designed to look as if they'd either just gotten out of bed with a gorilla or just about to get into it. Still, outdoor people were outdoor people. If that made people laughable, then he was a fool, but the fact was his heart was lightening. This was his favorite time of year. He settled down to the drive north. He felt happier every minute. Outside the car, the forest began to change from deciduous to more conifers. The light was going down. At this time of twilight, the poorish farmhouses of northeastern Minnesota were lighted from within, so they looked as indomitable as pioneers' huts. Whatever life was going on in them, it was no more deprived than what went on elsewhere. Vern began to feel peaceful, a little glassy. He would spend the weekend with his parents. He was returning to the world of no particular ambition. So many people of his hometown simply ignored their own fates. It wasn't so much that they wasted their lives as that they never caught sight of them. They were like people with closets full of various nations' uniforms. Each morning they reached for one and put it on without caring which. At least, Vern thought, from now on, he himself would no longer be just one more ugly American making serious ugly money. It was absolutely dark by the time Vern pulled in alongside Stan Garris's convenience pump. Garris Auto Sales was basically a dealership and repair place, not a service station. But like other business people in any small town, its owners did extra favors. Stan kept a convenience pump. He'd once handed Vern two of the $800 worth of Viking tickets that he gave away each season to car buyers and leasers and insurance guys. Vern had done the last 60 miles up from Cloquet on a low tank so that he could fill up his tank at Stan's. He waited in the shadowy interior of his car. Vern expected Stan's mechanic, or maybe Stan's elder statesman of a salesman, George Herslick, would come out and pump for him. It was Stan himself who approached, looking shaky. Vern had never heard any talk about Stan drinking on the job. Stan set the nozzle and worked around wiping headlights, the windshield, finally the outside mirror on Vern's side. The man looked terrible. Not drunk, Vern thought. He might be sick. Vern leaned out his window a little. On impulse, he said, "Let me tell you, Stan, I just got up here from the goddamn Twin Cities. Let me tell you, Stan, it's been a bad week down there." Stan stopped wiping. He looked touched by the friendly, tasteless speech. He looked in at Vern with his old man's wrinkled eyes. "Today was a terrible week anywhere," he said. Vern considered, then asked, "What happened?" Stan's eyes filled with tears. "Silver," he said, "it's silver." Ah, Vern said, it's horrible when a nice dog like Silver goes. I'm sorry, Stan. She didn't look that old either. She didn't die, Stan said. Someone stole her a couple of days ago. She'd never run. Someone either got in and stole her from where she takes her naps on that couch in the car showroom, or they could have got her while she was out back. That's horrible, Vern said. Stan brought over the signing board. Vern took the ballpoint pen. Listen, Stan, how about you get in and we go over to the old VFW and I buy you a drink? By that time of year, the VFW's fake bare-branched trees already stood in their Christmas pots along the front sidewalk. The tiny twinkling lights already twinkled. The two men felt mollified and went in. All booths up and down both sides were filled, but Pearl pointed them to a table jammed in the middle of other tables full of people. Go ahead, Stan, go ahead, Vern, she yelled from the liquor shelves behind the bar. Take that table. I haven't had a chance to wipe it off yet, but no Packers fan threw up on it as far as I know. I'll get you guys in 1 second flat. Stan and Vern slunk into their chairs and praised her a little. Pearl might be a generally terrible organist and an occasionally terrible accompanist for the ecumenical chorus each fall, but she was a wonderful bartender. Her passion in life, however, was neither playing the piano badly nor minding the VFW post well. She was a casino addict. Stan had a new Pearl casino story to tell Vern. Fresh from Bernie Stukowski, who had got it from his deputy, who wasn't good for much except telling anecdotes. Pearl had been waiting for a certain hot machine that she liked in Hinckley one night, but a guy had been holding it down for hours. Finally, the guy asked for the girl to come around with the ice cream carton for cashed-out coins. He took the bucket of coins and peed into it so he wouldn't have to leave the machine. Pearl raised a howl because she'd wanted that machine for so long. The guy made a mistake. He laughed at her. She got her fist under the bucket as for serving a volleyball, splashed the whole bucket full of quarters and pee into the man's chest and neck. Security threw them both out. Vern appreciated everything about that story. The combo of his first beer and the mental image of urine and coins flying restored him. At a table right behind Stan, St. Percy's all-purpose slob, Brad Strop was carrying on. Nothing new about that, but Vern was surprised that people were listening to him, asking him questions even. Who would wreck part of their Friday night listening to Brad Strop? Vern said to Stan, what's that all about? Stan said, that's right. You just got back from the cities, didn't you? Told Vern what had happened in St. Percy that day. A young girl's body had been found rolled down into the ditch on the east side of 53, just south of town. No one knew anything yet, and Brad had got caught in a beaver trap right nearby. Vern and Stan let themselves listen to Brad ranting at the table behind Stan. What Brad was telling everybody was that, by some coincidence, that old kraut, Dieter Stoltz, had come along when I had my ankle stuck in a beaver trap. Just a coincidence? Hey, that's all I was saying, but hey, kind of was a coincidence, wasn't it? Brad explained that Stoltz could have been actually murdering that girl while Brad was still stuck in the trap and then comes along and acts like a Boy Scout and gets Brad out of the trap, helps him out to the highway. But wouldn't you think it was kind of funny? They must have went right by that girl's body. But did Stoltz mention it to Brad? No, sir, he didn't. So, hey, Brad was not pointing fingers, but it made you think. Pearl had come up with her tray. Yeah, well, it doesn't make me think, said Pearl. She gave Vern and Stan a new pitcher. The early serious drinkers were already there, but they hadn't wound themselves up to any ugliness. Among them were people whose driving over the years had given Stan Garris's auto lot its most reliable repair and replacement business. These people wrapped their cars around trees at 1:30 or 2 in the morning. To use Bernie Stokowski's official language, these people lost control of their vehicles. If they had totaled whatever they had been driving, Stan got to hear about it. He would wander by their place of work. If they had a place of work and mention that he had just got in a 94 Honda hatchback, no rust. Some Californian had traded it to him, Stan would add. He wasn't much of a Honda man himself, but this one looked good. and he had it out himself and taken it here and there. Went down the road good. Fern had once bought a car from Stan. It happened during one of his between jobs times. He remembered how warm and full and friendly Stan's voice said, "Hell, Vern, try her out." They were standing out back of Garris Auto's, where the very, very used cars were. It runs very quietly. Stan remarked, "But it was manufactured by human beings. It's been driven by human beings, so it isn't perfect. I don't know about you, Vern, but pretty much what I want out of a car is it goes down the road good, and I like to know the guy who's selling it to me." Even though Vern would be buying a piece of transportation from Stan's back concrete slab, not anything from his nice showroom, Vern felt sure that Stan respected him and the car both. Now Vern knew he was getting drunk fast, but there you are. Feelings are feelings. He threw back the rest of his beer, made Pearl come back with another pitcher. He got Stan to tell him about Silver. Stan said he had checked everywhere, even at the range shelter for dogs. He told Stan how everyone in town loved that dog, and everyone in town knew her one trick. "Do you know about her one trick?" Stan asked. Vern said he was fuzzy about it. "How did that go, anyway, that trick?" Stan told him, "Oh, it wasn't that much." "How'd it go, though?" Vern said. Stan would tell Silver, "Listen, Silver, you know life is cruel. A man doesn't have a sporting chance if a bunch of rich guys organize against him. You know that, don't you, Silver?" Silver would whine right there. Then Stan would say, "Yep, Silver, a bunch of people, they organize, they decide to screw you, and you know what, Silver? You get screwed, that's what. But I don't know." Here Stan would pause and put hands on Silver's cheeks below her ears. "Gee, Silver, I should give you a chance to say what you think. People are always telling dogs what to think. They never ask dogs for their opinion. What do you think, Silver?" At that cue, the intelligent lab would lift her head from his hands and give from her powerful throat an incredible, wonderful howl, and she'd keep it up and keep it up. But Stan didn't go all the way with the story this time. He didn't imitate her howl the way he sometimes did. He just went on talking to Vern. He told Vern he would take Silver out walking around in that slough near the old Tenebrae family bridle path, south and east of town. He and Silver knew everybody who walked around in the woods. They were a different breed from other townsfolks who never went outside. No names mentioned. Vern egged him on, and he also discreetly caught Pearl's eye. She came over with a fresh pitcher, and she refilled their bowls of chips. She handed Vern a bowl of salsa, too. "Try this. I think it tastes like rat blood. Looks like it, too." Stan was now saying he and Silver didn't use the slough just for serious hunting. They went out there all times of year. Silver knew when it was season, and her job was to raise a bird at the right time and at the right distance for whatever Stan was carrying. Stan swore she would check which gun he'd brought along that day. She would figure the yardage to get up birds for him. She also knew when it was off-season, and therefore okay to go after other stuff that didn't mean anything to Stan. She went after stuff that was passionately desirable for her to kill, creatures low to the ground and pungent and disgusting, creatures that needed to be killed, and it took her, Silver, to do it. Muskrats and ordinary water rats and other varmints, animals she despised. She was careful to get her teeth into their necks just so and then flip them up into the air, so at the top of their helix the neck snapped. She would listen for that snap. Now Stan and Vern felt happy, both of them, even Stan, just thinking about how good that sound felt to Silver. "Right at the top of arc," Stan repeated, "you'd hear that little beast's neck bust clean." A fellow who had been seated with his back to Stan now turned around and gave Stan and Vern a primitive jeer. Vern knew he had already looked at that ugly face this evening, but now the beer inside Vern blurred the man's face. The man said, "If you two guys don't sound like a couple of environmentalists." Oh, yes, Vern thought. That's who that was, Brad Strapp. Not good, Vern thought, the word environmentalist. Not a good word at the VFW. In St. Fursey, a lot of people had the idea that that environmentalists were out to wreck your job or your pastime or both. If you were prospecting for gold 12 miles farther north out of town, environmentalists would be the ones organizing an attack on you with their desktop published brochures about how washing gold flushed cyanide into the land. If you were anything to do with the Rocky Mountain prospectors, environmentalists would try to get the state to plug your trial holes with concrete because uranium was supposed to be something bad. If you were not doing any of those projects, but were just eking out a little weekend cash flow when the taconite hiring was thin, then environmentalists got you fined for just laying a line or two for beaver. Vern felt sorry that Brad's drop was coming on like someone who might in the next moment relieve his concerns by deciding to slap someone around. Now that could be a bad end to an already very bad day, especially when Vern had begun to feel human again, with some self-respect. Well, he'd been a public speaker for a few years, so he gathered himself to speak in a sharing, nurturing, crowd-soothing way. He said, "Actually, we're talking about how someone stole Stan's dog. It's what we're talking about. Actually, one of those really great dogs, too." Brad said, "You want my opinion? Dogs are dogs. People keep talking. They have this great hunting dog. They have this great show dog. They have this great something else kind of dog. Well, since you ask, a dog's a dog. Dogs bite. Dogs bark. That's pretty much it for dogs." Stan hadn't moved. Now he did. He slowly rose to his feet in his crabbed, unhealthy-looking way that was so saddening now. Vern was there to see it. Stan turned around so he could place the heel of his right hand onto Strop's nose and left cheek. Then he arranged his thumb into Strop's right eye. When he was all set, he shoved. Strop gave a howl that converted into a little scream. In the blurry background far away, Vern saw Pearl rise from her stool behind the bar. Vern himself came around the table to get between Stan and Brad. He braced himself and got off what started as a nice, ordinary, practical haymaker, except someone slapped his arm down. His fist went into the man's chest. "Oh, God, but that hurt. How come they never told you anywhere the real reason not to be violent? That it hurts to hit someone with your fist." Brad Strop's face still flapped like a piece of laundry right in front of him. Pearl had made her way gently between the tables. She didn't elbow into people on her way. She came gently. Now she was here. She sighed. She looked down. She saw Brad's bandaged ankle. Pearl reached out with her right foot and hooked it and gave his ankle a swift half turn. He went down. His shoulders tipped over and wasted the whole hardly touched pitcher of beer. Then Pearl returned to the bar and removed the wall phone earpiece from its hook. She gave a fine shout that everybody could hear. "All right, everyone, all right, all right." Stan Garris must have heard her just as well as anyone else, but Vern saw that Stan couldn't resist one last moment's work. Stan reached for Brad Strop's knees. He lifted them high above the table level and then gave a push, as if the head, shoulders, stomach, the rest of the man were a wheelbarrow. Bradstrop's whole body flowed smoothly across the beer-wet table like a new ship going down its ways. That got some clapping, high fives, more clapping, the whole room. "All right, damn it," Pearl shouted over the laughing. "Okay, I've dialed, all right? Would you listen up now?" She was holding the receiver way up in the air, the room stilled. "Okay, guys," she said with perfect enunciation, "I've got the chief of police on the end of the line. We do plan A or we do plan B. Plan A is you keep on fighting and spilling drinks and tearing up my post. Then a lot of you spend the rest of your Friday night in the slammer at Culla. Plan B, you quiet down as of right now and Bernie and Glass get to have the rest of their supper in peace. So what's it going to be?" Everyone sat down except Vern and Stan. Brad Strop rose from the floor, but only as far as to sway on all fours, hands and knees, not hurting anyone. Pearl said unnaturally loudly, "Okay." She turned to the wall speaker of the phone. "Okay," she shouted into it. Bernie, they decided to get their butts in gear. She replaced the earpiece into its cradle. Vern offered his arm very formally to Stan, the way we had once seen some Buddhist kid hanging around that Duluth woman for peace, help an old, visiting, Rinpoche. Here we go, everybody, Vern said loudly to the whole room. Yep, here we go, right? They proceeded toward the front like church ushers. People clapped for him and Stan. They owed those fellows. Sometimes you sat for hours at the VFW and nothing worth mentioning happened. Well, not this Friday night. Vern had to put his arm around the tired Garris to steer him through the crowded tables. Here we go, on our way, Pearl. When they had got to right alongside the bar, Vern managed to pull a 20 out of his free hand. With a great arching reach, he got it over to Pearl, like someone semaphoring from the bridge of a major ship. Pearl gave Vern a brilliant, compassionate, utterly feminine smile. She pocketed the Jackson and said in full musical voice, "Well, Denham, what do you know?" He thought, full of love, how that old Pearl knew a man when she saw one. Then he had to figure out where the door lever was. That door had to be like other doors. Had to have a lever or a knob, so he concentrated to find it. Vern sobered a little as he drove Stan to the lot. Stan's own car stood there, looking very lonely under the overhead yard light. Vern got out his side of the car and went around to open the passenger door. Stan didn't get out somehow. Maybe he had hurt his back, hefting most of Brad's drop all the way to shoulder height like that. The two men just paused. A loon gave its nervous trill, once, then again, from the direction of the lake. "I've always been partial to loons," Stan said leisurely. He added, "You'd better give me a ride home, Vern. I'll leave the car here." When they were on the way again, Stan said, "Know what, Vern? I am actually a sick man." Stan's hands kept climbing over one another in his lap. Stan said, "It's true. Apparently I'm awfully sick. Now they want to do chemo on me and all. But here's the thing, Vern. If I could just get Silver back, if I could just get her back, I would make sure she was taken care of okay." Vern tried to pay attention to Stan, but it was very difficult because he himself was so drunk. No, he thought, that's a lie. That wasn't why. It was very difficult because his own heart was flaring and flaring with happiness. He was designing the proposal he would make tomorrow. He was working on the phrases. He would tell Imogene Tenebrae, "Listen, you have to marry me. You have to let go of your soft-head father with his cheery Republican buddies and his crooked contacts with sadistic chemical companies and all the other crap-filled spooky money bags he wills and deals with. You have to just leave him behind because you and I are going to get married, so we will be happy. We will be happy Americans." What a concept, Imogene. "You and I are going to be happy." Vern felt there might be things wrong with that speech, but tomorrow was another day. He would have time to get the bugs out of it.
You've been listening to Episode 6 of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly. This book will run for 20 episodes through July 23rd. If you miss a day, remember that all the week's episodes are posted on our website, ktwh.org, on the Literally from the North Shore page, on the program's drop-down menu at the top of the homepage. Be sure to tune in again for the next episode of Shelter Half.